There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap, and I'm Malcolm Taylor. In the hour, we hear from our panelists who are at the Etisalat Hello Business Hub in JLT for our SME event this morning, Getting Started. Plus, on the back of yesterday's discussion about blind CVs, we're going to find out what the UAE law really says about discrimination in hiring. And also, a government body has issued a warning to real estate developers. But first of all, we're hearing from Richard Dean, who's been speaking to Fahid Al-Kasimi, partner at AQ&P.
So you've been invested in a wide range of businesses right at the early stages, from Surf House, which is a restaurant, through to AQ&P, which is a corporate governance consultancy. What's the common thread between all these diverse businesses? You've now recently invested in Seafood Soup, which is a fish distribution business. So there's a real broad range there. But what's the common thread?
I think in light of the discussion today here at the Etisalat Hello Business Hub, it's important to talk about the practicalities. The practicalities that exist no matter what business you start are common. Number one, you need to work out how much money you're going to need to start, whether that's your trade license, where your offices are going to be, the amount of staff that you will need to launch, how are you going to get internet and Wi-Fi, with Etisalat in the building that you're in. Are you going to fit out the office, or are you going to rent something that's already fitted out? No matter what happens, there is a point or a period of time from when you start to when your first client pays you. And I think that is my message to all of the people that ask me the questions today, is that you need to make sure you have the funds available, the strategy in place to get through what is, in my opinion, the most difficult time of any startup or business, which is, great, we've launched, and then we're going to write our first invoice.
I've also read comments from you saying sometimes the best way to approach launching a business is not to launch a business. And again, I'm paraphrasing here, but you've talked about the glamorization of the role of the entrepreneur in the wake of people like Steve Jobs is perhaps dangerous in some respects. Give us your take on that.
Most importantly, Richard, I think we are in a period in time in which the valuations of companies are driven a lot by intangible returns, whether that be I have a lot of data, or I have a large social media following, I have access to information, and putting value on those intangibles can sometimes spur a group of entrepreneurs to raise funding in perpetuity. We're going to just raise another round to keep going. We're losing money for now, but in the long term, we will make money. And I won't mention, the few companies that I've spoken about before that I think are, valued in the billions, but really haven't started making money.
These are the kind of Silicon Valley unicorns or decacorns, as the $10 billion companies are called.
If you read on WeWork for the last 6 weeks, I think you'll understand exactly the points that I'm trying to get to. My message to entrepreneurs here is that, one, to survive, and two, to create value, the most important thing you need to do is make money. Where we have cautioned companies that we've either invested in or advised as AQ&P is to imagine that you will not raise the next round of funding. And that's when it's a do or die situation, a fight or flight situation for the entrepreneur. How will you survive? Our recommendations are to most entrepreneurs is that if you being an entrepreneur does not mean that you need to go and create the next digitally enabled platform that's going to take the world by storm. But the Surf House, for example, is a surf school, a retail shop, and a restaurant that we started with very little money. That now employs 20, 30 people, is visited by millions of people a year in Jumeirah, and is a business that has survived for now 14 years.
Finally, when you're looking at something like a restaurant like Surf House, there are, 12,000 restaurants in Dubai. When you're looking to something like Parkour DXB, which you were one of the founding investors in, again, there's lots of entertainment and sports facilities in a place like Dubai or across the UAE. How do you find a point of difference there?
Our focus on all of the projects that I've invested in, and this is maybe a personal ethos of myself and the firm AQ&P, when we invest in something, we look at the community that we create around it. There is a lot of choice in this market, in Dubai being this global business hub. You have options in every industry sector. The most important thing is to offer something of value and to build a community around that. We have the same faces that come in, day out, at Surf House, learning how to surf, feeling part of the surf community. At Parkour DXB, the schools and the parents that come and bring their children to learn how to move better and feel better. Happy is another example, a restaurant that I co-founded with one of my best friends. And there we see this community of people that understand the values in which we formed an F&B concept that puts quality ingredients before anything else. As long as you focus on really what the core value is rather than going out there and just trying to sell to stay afloat, I think you'll see a lot more sustainability in the entrepreneurial space.
30 seconds on corporate governance. Isn't corporate governance just for big companies, the Etisalats of this world? What's it got to do with SMEs and startups?
You know how to make me happy first thing in the morning by asking me about corporate governance. Richard, it's something that I advocate for across the region. I've worked with large multinationals on it, and I firmly believe that there's an opportunity for SMEs to start looking at ways in which to protect their business, to be transparent to their shareholders, to their clients, to their customers, and watch this space for some interesting announcements soon.
Fahim Alkasemi, great talk to you. Appreciate you being here today.
Thank you so much.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. I am Malcolm Taylor.
Rich is down at our big SME event that we're doing at the Etisalat Hello Business Hub. 40 Business Breakfast listeners, budding entrepreneurs, getting some great advice. We're going to hear now from Rich, who is joined by one of the experts on his panel, finding out how to do new business right.
Thanks, guys. Yeah, down here at the Etisalat Hello Business Hub in JLT with one of our speakers this morning, Neil Petch, who's the founder of Virtue Zone, not only an entrepreneur in his own right, but he's helped nearly 16,000 other companies set up. Neil, great to have you with us. Let us know, what have you learned over your career as an entrepreneur? You're talking about five things that people don't tell you about starting a business. What can you share with us?
I guess the first thing is we're celebrating our 10th anniversary, by the way. So 10 years ago, we started this thing, and we were the very first people offering what is essentially is a quasi-government service. So if you ask me what's the biggest challenge that we faced, and the first challenge as well, it was simply, I suppose, having the cojones to make the jump. It was, we were offering this service, we were offering, selling free zone licenses from mainland Dubai, and that was the very first time that that was actually available. In today's market, organizations like the Chamber of Commerce, DED, the Mohammed bin Rashid Fund for Entrepreneurs and SMEs, make this sort of thing very, very approachable and easy for first movers. But in those days, it wasn't quite so easy. So actually making the jump was the first challenge.
And I guess one of the things you've had to do is perhaps almost reinvent yourself. As you say, back then there was a real pain point, a problem setting up a business as an SME, perhaps less so now, and yet you're still helping more companies set up. You're still a thriving business. How have you had to change and adapt to the market?
It's still the same challenge, actually. I mean, if we listen to our fathers, if you listen to old me, it's still the same thing. It's trying to spot a gap and fill the gap. So in our case, when we started, we were working with government entities. Those government entities, and today we're lucky enough to be in this wonderful facility that Etisalat have put together. Both of them are, they have huge resource. They're like an oil tanker. They have massive resource. They also, that resource is an asset that they have to protect, which means that sometimes they can't move quite so nimbly. We were like the speedboat that was able to partner with them and go and have a look around and see where opportunities lay. If that was a good thing, then we could come back, report to the mothership and move forward. So from the respect of how we worked with the government 10 years ago, what we did for the very first time is finance the setting up of companies. So Richard, if you came to us and for the wonderful gig that you do, wanted to set up a business, you could pay that over the course of the year. So suddenly, overnight, that opened up a whole brand new sector for the market of people that didn't think that owning their own business was attainable.
You've helped, as we said, almost 16,000 businesses set up. Some of them succeed, of course, many of them don't. What's the common thread that you've seen among those that have really succeeded?
I think when someone, you know, we set up about 350 a month, and when people come in, it's a wonderful environment because, of course, they're making their dream turn into a reality. And you see, you know, I suppose it's really exciting. You see the ones that you know they're just going to work right from the start, and we get a feel for that.
Is it the business plan? Is it the business model? Or is it the people?
I would say that you know sometimes people come in with a brilliant idea, but unfortunately it's the wrong person to execute it. So the idea, whilst of course it's the thing that starts everything, is not the most important thing. If I had to pick one thing, I'm going to be really boring and cliched and say cash is king. Now that doesn't mean just the cash to set up your actual company license, to set up your office. It actually means being ready. So plan. Don't get tripped up. I suppose here's a one for you. Don't be tripped up by your own growth, because that's absolutely unforgivable.
Finally, you're going to be talking about five things they don't tell you about setting up your own business. We haven't got time for all five, but give us one thing that nobody told you before you set up your own business and you wish you'd known.
Another obvious one, it's recruitment. So, you know, if you're in for a short-term killing, maybe it's not important, but most of us would be trying to lay our foundations and would be trying. So recruit quality, be prepared to pay for it. And that doesn't just mean salary. It means creating the environment that the best people want to come and work for you. So that means allowing them to take risks, allowing them to innovate, and of course supporting them and giving them the best conditions that enable them to want to come to work for you, and when they're working for you, feel that they're really doing something.
Neil Petch, founder of Virtue Zone, great talking to you. Appreciate you being here.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. My name is Malcolm Taylor.
We're going to get some advice now, actually, about the legalities of hiring. Yesterday on the Business Breakfast, we ended up in quite an emotional discussion about blind CVs. In case you missed it, blind CVs are those without age, gender, nationality, even maybe a name on them, so that there can be no bias, unconscious or otherwise, in candidate selection. And a lot of you got in touch to say what you'd seen and whether or not you thought this would help or not. A lot of you also had a lot of legal questions about what companies could actually do when it came to discriminating whilst hiring. So we have Rebecca Kelly, employment lawyer at Morgan Lewis, in the studio with us to make sure that we all know all the facts. Rebecca, lovely to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Brandy.
What does the law actually say when it comes to discrimination in hiring and in advertising for a job?
Well, the law is both onshore and offshore. So part of the discussion yesterday probably dealt with the DIFC law, which is far more prescriptive than the federal law. And the DIFC law has a specific provision in their employment regulations that requires a company to not treat any individual less favourably based on what we would call protected characteristics, which includes religion, gender, ethnicity, nationality, all of those, which is largely in part exactly the same as what they would do in Abu Dhabi Global Markets as well. But within the UAE, we also have the federal system, and a lot of people talk about the anti-discrimination and hatred law, which was a federal piece of legislation that was enacted a couple of years ago, on the assumption that that will apply to anti-discriminatory practices in an employment space. But in actual fact, what it does is it doesn't prescribe what you can and can't do when it comes to advertising for positions. What it does do, though, is penalise a manager of an organisation should there be discriminatory practices. So when you look at that, you're not actually required prohibited, let's say, from advertising for particular types of people to fill particular occupational requirements. But what you will find is if you employ people and you treat them in such a way that is discriminatory or against the federal law, then there are quite severe penalties for that. But it's none of the laws, DIFC, ADGM or the federal law, specifically state that you can or cannot advertise for certain types of individuals to fill those roles.
Does that discrimination extend to making people pay the same salary for the same position?
It's an interesting question because what we have is a labour law from 1980, and that law actually set up the groundwork for non-gender discrimination. So it actually says women should be paid, for example, the same amount of money as a man for the same work, which surprises a lot of people because they assume that actually all of the gender equality has been something of late. But what you will actually find is that the level of salaries insofar as what you offer people, as long as it's not directly linked to their nationality, then you wouldn't be treating somebody less favourably for the application of the
law.
But
you cannot discriminate by nationality.
You cannot discriminate by nationality. And the hatred law, as we call it, the anti-discrimination and hatred law, is really about tolerance. And it's all about a lot of the provisions in the law are about making sure that people within the community are not inciting any sort of racial hatred towards particular individuals because of their race or their religious beliefs.
Are there any laws around what people can ask you during interview? Can someone ask you, for example, and we had lots of people getting in touch with us yesterday, about your age? Can they ask you if you're married, if you have plans to have children?
What I see in practice is that companies that are recruiting people will not do that, especially if they've got internal policies around making sure that they are transparent in their hiring practices and that they actually want to have and apply good corporate governance. But what I do see also is that people will ask that. Whether or not that's a discriminatory practice is really down to whether or not the law applies to that particular situation. And in most circumstances, the federal law would not apply to those situations.
Where we seem to be hearing most about it is when someone wants to ask about a spouse, usually a husband's package. Do they get school fees? Do they get health insurance for the family, etc.? Is it okay to ask that?
It is okay. Nothing in the law says that it's not okay, but then, of course, you've got companies that probably would not say that. And I think the other aspect of that is whether or not you are going to comply with diversity statistics for your company. You may want to make sure that you actually do employ women or do employ people from different ethnicities, or that you also, and I know that one of the points that was raised yesterday was emiratisation, which we're seeing in other GCC countries as well.
From a lawyer's point of view, I imagine that a lot of these accusations would be very difficult to substantiate. I mean, how on earth do you prove or disprove something?
That's right. And that's why the distinction between pre-employment, so through the application process, and then whilst you're employed is quite clear in, for example, the DIFC and the ADGM law, because actually what we're talking about is people that are within their workplace being treated less favourably on the basis that they believe it's because of their religion, their gender, or their marital status or something else. Now, the proving of that the burden of proof actually lies on the individual making the accusation. So the company doesn't have to disprove necessarily that they have applied a certain standard, because the law isn't as prescriptive as perhaps it is in other jurisdictions. When you have the UK, they have a specific Employment Equality Act that actually sets out exactly what they deem to be equal employment opportunities and fair treatment within a workplace. We don't go so far as that. So what we're relying on is when you're proving something, for example, you are going to have to rely on the information that you've received by management. So if you received an email that specifically said, and no one is ever going to receive this type of an email, you are not going to be promoted because now that you're married, we don't deem that you're right for this position. So the proving of it, you're absolutely right, is fundamentally the biggest issue that an employee would have.
Rebecca Kelly, employment lawyer at Morgan Lewis. So nice to have you in the studio. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai I 103.8.
Good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap.
Very pleased to be joined now by the one, the only, Natasha Thomas in the studio with us. Natasha.
I love that introduction.
What's in the news?
Well, what's in the news is the astronaut launch. We are getting very excited here in the newsroom, and we are looking forward to the big day, which is tomorrow. Now, the Abu Dhabi Crown Prince has wished the first Emirati astronauts ahead of the historic mission to the International Space Station. His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi and Deputy Supreme Commander of the UAE Armed Forces, spoke over the phone to Hazza Al Mansouri and his backup Sultan Al Nayadi. Now, Sheikh Mohammed said both the astronauts represent every Emirati and the nation is lucky to have them. For their part, Al Mansouri and Al Nayadi expressed sincere thanks to the UAE's leadership for their unswerving support. And you can watch that video of that conversation on the ARN News Center app. So just for those people who have been living under a rock, who don't know, Hazza Al Mansouri and two other astronauts, one from Russia and the other from the USA, will be launched on board a Soyuz rocket from the Baikonur Cosmodrome Space Center in Kazakhstan at 5:56 p.m. tomorrow.
And it puts the UAE on the space list. Only 18 different nationalities have been up to the ISS, so this will be the 19th, and very happy to have them. Two people have been up five times, believe it or not. Five return trips.
But that's just greedy.
And five people have been up four times, so there's a lot of multiples as well. But UAE, well done, be up there with all those other big nations.
Yeah. And I imagine they've been there multiple times because these are obviously qualified space engineers, and the reason they go up to ISS, they have to do maintenance work on the
station. I expect so. Every time the satellite TV's not working, they get a call out. You know.
Can you get on that rocket? So, yes, obviously, for the UAE, it's a massive, massive deal. This is the first time an Emirati is going into space, and we wish him all the best.
What else is going on, Natasha?
Well, we're looking at the Aadhaar card, which is the unique identity card for Indians. And it seems now Indian expats in the UAE can now apply for it. Previously, it was only issued to residents of the country. But the system is now being rolled out globally for non-resident Indians or NRIs. But it is still optional. And it comes after the government decided to remove a mandatory 180-day stay in India as a requirement to obtain the card. So Indian expats can now book an online appointment even before they land in the country, and then they can head to the centre of their choice and submit their documents when they reach India.
And I've got a story, and it's actually a warning, and it's possibly the most interesting warning that I have ever heard from an official body here in the UAE. It's come out from RERA, the Real Estate Regulatory Agency. RERA, because Cityscape is starting tomorrow, and we've got the big Cityscape conference as well, they've issued a warning to real estate developers and brokers not to chase investors across parking lots and in corridors during Cityscape.
Wow.
True story.
That is fascinating.
I didn't know this was a thing, but clearly, I mean, we know that the market is soft, but is it soft enough that you will chase a would-be investor down a corridor?
On the other hand, if you did let somebody chase you across a car park or down a corridor, you're probably going to get a pretty good deal at the end of it if you're looking to buy. They are going to be desperate, aren't they, if they're doing that?
There's an official circular. It's come out from RERA and the CEO. They have told real estate developers and brokers that they have to provide any services only through their stands, and any violation will result in a penalty.
You can chase me as far as the door, but if I get through the door first, you're out of bounds.
Stands only.
I wonder if anybody can issue an official circular for, you know, PR agencies who chase journalists at these events.
It's a very good point.
Thank you for listening. We're back tomorrow at 6 a.m. with the Business Breakfast Breakfast, bringing you the latest as the UAE prepares to send an astronaut up to the ISS.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.